right, we'll open up the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation for Thursday, February 5th. And we have a number of bills for public hearing today and some possible work sessions. What I'm going to do is I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bills 169, 170, and 171. Ask Mr. Stenberg to give us a brief overview of the three that are before us.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Senate Bill 169 adds airports with permanent control towers to the list of airports for which land use and activity rules must be adopted by Land Conservation and Development Commission. It requires local governments to amend comprehensive plans and land use regulations to be consistent with all the CDC rules for airports by December 31st, 2014. Senate Bill 170 increases from 3 to 6 the number of rural airports eligible for the Oregon Department of Aviation pilot projects, encouraging the so-called through-the-fence economic development within the airport boundaries. And Senate Bill 171 prohibits construction of physical hazards to air navigation without first obtaining permits from the Oregon Department of Aviation.
Okay, let's start with Mr. Clem from the Department of Aviation. And Mr. Clem, I'll have you give us your summary, each one of the bills, and then we'll go to testimony on individual bills. Okay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee, my name is Dan Clem. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Aviation. Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to hear these bills and present these bills. Senate Bill 169 is all about the airport planning rule. You have two handouts. One is a two-page explanation of the airport planning rule. Describes the Oregon Administrative Rules, Chapter 660.013 that was passed in 1994, or put into rule in 1994, to really disassociate communities, encroaching communities, and airports in terms of flight patterns, depending on the size of the airport and how many aircraft that they currently serve. It also distinguishes between publicly owned, privately owned, and public use and private use airports. Also contained in your packet is a spreadsheet. If I could draw your attention to a spreadsheet that looks like this with the colored wheels. What we've been doing in the last 2 years, Mr. Chair, is taking a look at how many land use jurisdictions, over 150 of them, have been in compliance with the airport planning rule. In 94, when this was passed into rule, the compromises and decisions that were made at the time were to, in fact, impose the requirement that land use jurisdictions implement into their comprehensive land use plans necessary rules and regulations to identify what uses were allowed at the airport, what sorts of safety overlay zones and what type of zone was applicable. It allowed the local land use jurisdictions to make those. We provided a model for that, but allowed them to implement those into the comprehensive land use plan. And that was triggered by completion of periodic review. Since that time frame, periodic review has been altered, but in fact the airport planning rule has not. Thus, based on the type of airport and how many aircraft it serves, there is an issue of noncompliance. As the Director of Aviation, with the oversight of all aviation issues in the state of Oregon, what we have is a problem of land use and airports running into each other. If I could draw your attention to the spreadsheet, we've listed all the jurisdictions and the five basic requirements of the airport planning rule. They're different for each airport, but in summary, those public use airports that are publicly owned with three or more aircraft, we have about 75% of the land use jurisdictions which have not yet been able to incorporate the required changes to the comprehensive land use plan. With privately owned airports with private use aircraft, the compliance is actually better at 52%. Flipping the spreadsheet over, for those small rural airports with less than three aircraft, we essentially see 70% compliance. Some of that differences in compliance can be related to the fact that small rural airports only have to really essentially draw the overlay in terms of the approach departure surfaces. It's a safety overlay. It's a very basic overlay. It's templated. They just have to make sure that it's in their county land use or city land use plans so that when building permits come in, when development occurs, we don't have encroachment issues. One of the communities that I want to highlight is right here in my own hometown where I serve as a city councilor. City of Salem in Marion County has only adopted part of these. It's to be sure since 1994 an unfunded mandate. It probably was then, and this portends that potentially it is now. The issue is, though, we've got communities still growing into airports, and airports essentially flight patterns as they grow sometimes, impinging on communities. The airport planning rule does a good job of establishing a framework for land use and airport operations that guarantees aviation safety, as well as a sound financial land use planning. My intent is not to create new unfunded mandate. I have to portray that the airport planning rule was, in fact, in 1994, an unfunded mandate and only required to be done in periodic review. I am looking for a solution to be able to help land use jurisdictions find the time and the resources. Within my budget, I've requested the ability to change a fee structure to allow for financial aid in municipalities grants. Under the BAM grant program, municipalities would be prioritized if, in fact, they apply for competitive grants for to accomplish land use work that their staffs need to do. So what we tried to do is essentially say, look, in the last 15 years, we're at about 50% compliance. The idea is that, to put a date certain on it, was to hope that, in fact, before airports and communities have more encroachment issues, that the jurisdictions would find the resources and be able to complete the comprehensive land use plan changes that need to be made as provided in the airport planning rule. There are some potential amendments out there to move this from a date certain kind of bill to potentially allow that an area within, if there's a comprehensive land use plan within a half a mile of the airport, that in fact that at that time that would be the trigger to implement the requirement for the comprehensive land use plan zone changes. That amendment hasn't been drawn up yet, and we can discuss that further, Mr. Chair. But in essence, as communities continue to grow, and even during the current recession, we are still having issues on a frequent basis wherein airports and communities buffering and appropriate zoning and safety considerations are still not in place, and it's my responsibility to try to encourage and find ways to complete what was started in 1994. Again, in 15 years, we're at about 50% compliance. I'm concerned that in the next 15 years, there isn't too much incentive to improve on that figure. So this spreadsheet that I provided to you represents about the last 2 years of survey, and this is information garnered from the county planning officer. I'm willing to work with any of the constituent groups and obviously with the legislators to improve this bill, and we look forward to the opportunity to do that. With that...
Thank you. If you would go on with 170, then 171, and then we'll...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 170 is a continuation of the Fuel Defense Pilot Program that Oregon Legislature and Governor passed into law in 2005. The Fuel Defense Airport Program, currently established at Aurora Airport, Scappoose Industrial Airport, and the Bend Municipal Airport, is in fact still in its pilot program stages. We are seeing some successes, not so much in economic development yet at this time, but we are seeing some successes in the level of cooperation, the planning for the airport, and the creation of some jobs, particularly at the Aurora State Airport. We are wanting, as we work through the working groups, we've been contacted by a couple of communities who are interested in taking advantage of this program. The Sea Defense Program, in a nutshell, provides an orderly manner for which users, businesses off airport can be allowed and pay an access fee onto the airport to conduct business. The FedEx business right here at the Salem Airport is an example of a through the fence program. Any airport can do through the fence. What Oregon has done is established an orderly way of allowing the airport tenants to have a say in that, setting the fees, and putting some structure on it, because that's the FAA's main concern, is there are a lot of airports that allow through the fence operators, but they don't pay their fair share in terms of the access fee. Oregon has established that in statute and administrative rule, and in the through the fence program, there's a potential three other airports would like to join it. As we looked at what to do with the pilot program and how to make it better, we thought it might be better to potentially extend the through the fence pilot program to those other three airports. There is a provision in the bill that speaks to a Goal 11 exception under Section 3. I have been working with the chair to potentially remove that proviso that would have allowed airports in the Through the Fence pilot program with industrial zone land to be accepted under Goal 11. LCDC tells me that's pretty much already provided for. So to improve the bill, there's a pending amendment to remove Section 3. We have put that in there simply because some of the more rural airports were trying to seek some regulatory relief to the problem that really hurts the, or at least is a barrier to development of commercial and industrial activities on rural airports, particularly outside of the city's limits, and that's the provision of water and sewer services. But in further interpretation of it, it looks as though Section 3 isn't needed. So I'll be working with Chair Metzger if this comes back to work session, to remove that. Quite simply, the bill stands as an expansion of 3 airports to 6 airports under a pilot program we previously established in 2005.
Yeah.
With that, Chair Metzger and committee, Senate Bill 171 allows the Oregon Department of Aviation to issue a permit. First thing it finds is that a structure that penetrates the essentially the flight pattern or the approach surfaces to an airport from an airport is in fact not allowed, and then it allows the Oregon Department of Aviation to issue a permit. I'd like to draw the picture out of the Wasco wind tower situation that we're currently facing. Wind towers under the Klondike project went up on the south side alongside the runway. They clearly sitting up 660 feet in the air are in the flight pattern. Anything from 0 to 1,000 feet is in the flight pattern, in a flight pattern around that small rural airport in Sherman County. Great for economic development, great for renewable energy, a big surprise to pilots. Not a lot of users of the airport, but the Federal Aviation Administration funds a lot of small airports to a certain standard. That is that they be free of obstacles from 0 to 1,000 feet, that they have a standard rectangular box pattern, and that they have certain distances for approach and departure. A number of other more technical things, but in fact pretty simple. They've invested money since 1986 when FAA funds were used to build the runway, and now what I've got is I've got 4 wind towers sticking up in the flight pattern. I did the sensible thing. I revised the flight pattern such that I closed off the southern side of that flight pattern, the left-hand turn onto runway 25. Now, currently existing are roads and 4 concrete pads for wind towers on the north side of that airport. If I have to adjust the flight pattern any further, we're paying the FAA back potentially. What's happening is I'm not involved, the Oregon Department of Aviation, and I don't mean for all airports, but I mean just even for my own airport, mine meaning yours. The ability to understand that there are structures going up near the airport. They're off airport property, but they're clearly in the flight pattern. I'm trying to find a way, and I'm not sure that this bill is done yet, but I'm trying to find a way that allows the Oregon Department of Aviation or an airport sponsor to be involved in the FSEC process, but in fact to be in a position where it has some authority to intervene or be involved with the FAA process. Right now, it's between the FAA and the property owner. And the state of Oregon, the authority you've given me in statute is to determine a hazard, to establish standards for lighting and marking of the hazard, and to impose lighting and marking requirements generally on the hazard. A wind tower sticking up 660 feet in the air, in fact, you can put a light at the top of the tower itself, but the blades spinning another 100 some odd feet in the air, you can't exactly mark those. Wouldn't want to. The pilots would get dizzy. The problem is that I don't have a process right now, and I'm looking for a way to be able to intervene, have some say in a number of things. A couple of things. What tends to happen now is if, in fact, you go through the FSEC process, and FSEC can require certain conditions of the company that's putting in the wind tower or the cell tower or whatever building or structure it is, depending on the jurisdiction. The problem is that it always tends to be the developer or the person who's putting up the structure that has got to ameliorate or mitigate the hazard. There are instances where, in fact, the flight pattern of the airport could be reduced or could be changed somehow, or that navigational aids could be installed at the airport that would still provide the pilots a more accurate way of landing at the airport and taking off. An example of this is the LNG terminals that are approved for Astoria. The FAA required that the VOR approach at the Astoria Airport now be upgraded to a Doppler VOR approach. All that technical stuff aside, the reality of it, that's the first instance where I've seen the FAA actually require the airport to do something. The bottom line is, we're in the Department of Aviation. Nobody in the state has an ability to be involved in the siting process, nor do I have an ability in statute by the authority you grant me to be able to require the airport to do anything. I'm not sure this bill is complete yet. Amendments are being drafted to talk about an ability to not so much issue a permit, but in fact look at increasing my authority to mitigate the hazard. There are issues involving cell phone towers and EFUs that EFU lands that you'll want to address. I'm happy to be a part of those discussions. But the reality of it is, we have a fantastic renewable energy project that's running into a flight pattern, and we need to put some fixes in place that allow the state to be able to see that ahead of time and help mitigate the conflict of safety and renewable energy in that one instance. Was this bill brought forward because of that one instance? No. This bill was brought forward because Washington and California do this. We don't always do what Washington and California do, but in fact, they have some control to protect their airspace and also to be able to mitigate and allow for developments in certain construction of certain structures. So the issue is that this is a countrywide problem, and I think we ought to at least be involved in the process somehow. Right now it's between the FAA and the property owner, or if in the fact of a wind towers, the FSEC and the applicant. With that, I'm happy to work this bill with as you direct and find some way to protect airspace, which is my ultimate goal. With that,
okay. Thank you, Mr. Clem. I'll have you sit aside for a moment. I'm going to bring you back up, but for the moment, I'm going to close the public hearings on Senate Bill 169, 170, 171 because we have Mr. Penn here, and I want him to get back to work. So we'll come right back to this in a few minutes. But I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 83. Mr. Stanbridge, Mr. Penn, if you want to come forward. Just since you're here.
Committee Chair Metzger and members of the committee, this Senate Bill 83 exempts state lottery game devices from federal law prohibiting transport of gambling devices. You heard this on the 22nd of January. We have two notices, one notice of no revenue, one notice of no fiscal.
Okay, thank you. We were waiting for those. And we heard this bill previously did not hear the opposition to that, but I asked Mr. Penn to come here for the work session. So if any member has any questions about the bill or any interests or concern, Mr. Penn is here to answer those questions.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Starr.
Are you ready for motion?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 83 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 83 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Thank you, Mr. Penn. I'll go back and make lots of money for us. We need it.
Who would you like to carry?
Okay. Thank you. All right, we're going to reopen the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 169, 170, 171. Now that we've had the overview of Mr. Clem, what I'd like to have you do, Mr. Clem, is, because I'm sure we're going to have some questions, if you would come up and retake your place in the dais, and then and you stay there, and then we'll have other people come up on these different bills, and we won't have to have you come back and forth. So I'm starting with Senate Bill 169. Ask that Andy Anderson and Scott Ashcombe come forward. And we'll follow that with Mr. Schlack and Ms. Ludwig. And then questions on this issue. As you can no doubt have heard, colleagues, these bills certainly will have amendments beyond this, but we want to get the overview of whether these are things we want to continue to work on.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Andy Anderson. I live at 803 Cessna Street at Independence.
Oh, what a coincidence. Yes, sir.
And I'm expressing my interpretation of each of the possible effect on the Oregon Flying Farmers and the Oregon Agricultural Alliance.
Okay.
And we're in favor of the three bills, and the Senate Bill 169 requires legal planning agencies to amend their comprehensive plan to include aviation-related uses within an airport boundary and sets a time limit to comply, using this rules to be set by ODA and LCDC. This will strengthen the needed time compliance for the present airport planning law, and the Flying Farmers and the Oregon Agricultural Alliance are introducing a bill to establish an additional airport planning area that would be beyond the airport boundaries with a 3-mile radius from the main runway of all public use airports. The Flying Farmers would like to have this added to Senate Bill 169 as it applies to both private and public-owned airports. This would be a help to our Flying Farmer airstrips owners if they wanted to develop commercial or industrial operations with a control tower or however else to comply with this bill. I do not know of any Flying Farmer airstrips owners at this time would benefit at this, but we want to be proactive for the future. Mm-hmm. In 170, this bill would benefit our Flying Farmers owners who want to expand to commercial and industrial projects through the fence operations or actually on their properties. This would provide some help with the infrastructure and under the economic development planning. Senate Bill 171 is a bill to extend, is needed for all airports, including our Flying Farmer strips, to prevent hazards to air navigation and for non-aviation residential housing near airports. The housing issue is one we are concerned with in our APA, this airport planning area bill, and provides a legal description of an air park as a permitted aviation-related use, complementary to keeping airports operational. We need this description of air parks. We need this distinction of air parks from other residential housing that causes airports to be closed or to curtail operations by being swallowed up by urban sprawl. I recommend approval for all three Senate bills and to forward them on to the Oregon Senate for passage.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Mr. Ashcom?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Scott Ashcom with the Oregon Agricultural Alliance. The Agricultural Alliance is a general farm organization representing production agriculture in the state of Oregon, statewide and multi-crop production agriculture. We support 169, 170, and 171. We think that they're looking into the future and they're necessary for efficient planning of our land uses in the immediate area of public use airports. We just wanted to draw your attention to a bill that we will ask for introduction of, which adds the definition of a residential air park to the definition section of the statute of the Aeronautics Department. The reason that we need a definition of residential air park is because they do exist and they're a pretty good idea for the future, but there is no current existing definition in Oregon revised statute. So we have copied the definition from the Arizona revised statute of a residential air park, and we're going to propose with our bill simply to add that definition into Oregon, into the definition section of the Aeronautic Department statute, so that the definition will be there if it can ever be useful in the future. With that, we think that these three bills are heading in the right direction, and they're excellent, and we support them all. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I'm going to keep Mr. Clem up here, but any questions for Mr. Anderson or Mr. Ashcom? Yes, Senator Berger.
Well, I don't know if necessarily is a question for them. I just want a clarification, Mr. Chair, that
sure.
When you amend the comprehensive plan, that includes public hearings.
Mr. Clem, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, my experience as a city councilor is all comprehensive land use plans are exhaustive processes with multiple hearings.
So, follow up.
Yeah.
So I think for those people that might have some concerns, which have been expressed to me, about the fact that the public needs to be involved in those decisions, I just wanted it on the record that when you amend the comprehensive plan, that involves that process. Thank you very much.
Senator Schrader.
I'd have a follow-up with one 69, again, my concern is someone who just came from a local government position and actually having folks in our county that are impacted by potentially a local airport. How is this going, again, the public process, again, getting on the record with Senator Verger that it has to be extensive outreach, and the communities in the area that are affected by this need to be part of the process. But the other piece is the cost to local government in terms of amending a comprehensive plan. We haven't heard from any of my colleagues from the Association, or a few weeks ago they were my colleagues from the Association of Oregon Counties. But Chair Metzger, I'd be curious to hear what the impact would be on local government.
They are signed up next, so.
Okay. Because it is costly, and as you know, right now everyone is facing constrained budgets, so that is an issue that I hope will be brought forward.
Okay, thank you, Senator. Further questions for these two folks? Gentlemen, I'll let you step back. Mr. Clem, you're going to have to stay around for a while. Now we'll get the dynamic duo up. Art Schlack from Associated Oregon Counties and Linda Moligwig of League of Oregon Cities. And we'll be talking about 169 with you folks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and Senator Schrader kind of made an entry for me at this point. The Association of Oregon Counties is opposed to the adoption of Senate Bill 169 as currently drafted, and the major reason for that is the fiscal impact that the proposal would have on counties by establishing a date certain by which this body of work would need to be completed. I would just share with you that, you know, we realize that the airport planning rule was done in the mid-90s. I actually participated in the development not only of the statutes as it relates to airport planning, but also the airport planning rule. And at that time, you know, we raised the question about the impact, the fiscal impact of the regulations. And as then and as we currently have, both the legislature and state agencies commonly evade the fiscal impact of either statute or administrative rules with the idea that we will do the work at periodic review. And at that point, historically, there has been grants, and there are grants to local governments to undertake work through periodic review. And so we kind of sidestep the fiscal impact. And at this point, by putting a date certain, now we have the fiscal impact at a point in time when we know where it would be. And we are in a situation where, as you know, counties' fiscal situation is hard-pressed, to say the least. In fact, I know that in some counties, their planning departments, which are fee-driven, are losing 60 to 70% of the staff that they currently have to keep the doors open. So there is, I would say, no assurances that there will be any funding, or there is any funding at the local level, to undertake this work. I have had conversations with Mr. Clem, and he has indicated that he has in his budget some funds for grants to undertake this work. And I talked to some of the counties that would be subject to these requirements at this point, and the estimate is somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000 to $75,000 per county to undertake this work. So we're talking about $1 million to maybe $1.5 million that would need to be allocated to undertake the work at the local level. And there is no assurances, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that the legislature will be able to put sufficient funds either in Mr. Clem's budget or in DLCD's budget to assist counties in undertaking this work. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we're in a position that we will have to oppose 169 unless there is an assurance there is adequate funding to undertake this work and the assistance from the state to do that. With regard to Senate Bill 170, we are neutral with respect to that. I would just note that in the through the fence, there is a concurrence by the for those airports with the local government, and so there is the opportunity to raise to address any issues at the local level in doing that. And so we are neutral with respect to that. And with regard to Senate Bill 171, Mr. Clem and I have had some discussions with regard to some potential amendments, and we are more than happy to work with the aviation and Mr. Clem with regard to potential amendments to Senate Bill 171 with the idea that it is something that can be passed.
Thank you, Mr. Slack. Let's go to Ms. Ludwig, and then we'll ask questions.
Thank you. Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to talk a little bit about this Senate Bill 169. And I do just want to address my comments there. Cities have, we have similar concerns to Mr. Slack from AOC about the fiscal impacts. And I do want to put on the record a disclaimer. We have not had the opportunity to evaluate those fiscal impacts because we did not have the list of airports that would be impacted by this bill. Now that, I do, we can move forward with that and get you an accurate statement. From what I have heard talking to a few of our planners that have gone through this process, I believe what Art put in the record in terms of fiscal impacts may be low, actually, from my initial research. In that research, I started looking for resources that would help me. I printed out just a quarter of this document, which is the Airport Land Use Compatibility Guidebook that starts walking local planning officials through what they may and may not have to do. Again, this is a quarter of that direction. It does not tell those local planning officials exactly how to complete the work. It just describes what needs to get done. It's a considerable piece of work that this bill puts forward for local officials, local jurisdictions to try to complete. As we've heard before, the trigger for this work was periodic review initially, and what this bill contemplates is a hard and fast date. I'd like to put into the record that at the time that the periodic review trigger was contemplated or put into statute, more than half of the cities in the state still did not come under the guise of periodic review at that time. So this legislation that we currently have today did contemplate that more than half the cities of the state that had airports or were under that population threshold would not have to go through this planning exercise. Since that time, the periodic review population trigger has changed and has put a portion of cities, a much smaller portion, would be outside the purview of periodic review. So there is substantial cost here to this piece of legislation, and I'd like to get back to the committee on what that impact would be with cities.
Is that it? Is that it? Okay, thank you very much. So as I was looking over your list, Mr. Clem, and the comments from Mr. Slack and Ms. Ludwig, is that in your pie chart, as we look at these number of these airports, the ones with all the checks, you know, that rule work has been done. Correct. So our discussion, since I get from the counties and the cities, they don't object to the work. They object to the having the ability, the funds to actually complete the work. So we've actually never, we're really narrowing our discussion to those who have not had yet an opportunity to complete that work. And then seeing what that cost is, what those counties or cities are, and what that cost is. Is that a fair realization? Because I think, I guess my question would be for the two of you, just Mr. Clem was talking about his budget, and we don't know what's going to be here. But if we were to identify at least some dollars to continue the progress in this area, we would have to figure out who would have first shot at those dollars, because I think you're right, if it's anywhere, if we're trying to do them all at once, we probably won't be able to allocate the department that kind of money. But we might be able to allocate some monies to get a few more counties/cities with airports not yet in full review of their airport planning rule up to speed, then I would assume that you would be supportive of that to the extent that the dollars were there. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I'd like to say on the record that if we could identify a specific amount of dollars and a specific list of airports that could utilize those dollars or would utilize those dollars and make that legislation and that direction very, very narrow, we would likely be in support of it.
Mr. Chair, Art Slack for AOC. Our concern is the fiscal impact at this point. So if we're able to, as you indicated, identify a body of, or a number of dollars, we certainly would be supportive as long as, looking at meshing the dollars with the jurisdictions that would be required to do the body of work at this point.
So I think what Mr. Clem then... One thing for sure that we need to do is be able to identify, to kind of segment out where these places are, these airports, under whose jurisdiction they are, that might qualify for not only the dollars but the additional work that needs to be done, so that then, and then you folks can try to get an assessment of, under your responsible jurisdictions, what those costs might be. I mean, at least that gives us an opportunity to start pairing together some things. Questions from the committee? Yes, Mr. Slack.
Mr. Chair, if I might, just so that it's on the record, one of the concerns that some of the counties expressed to me in looking at the body of work at this point is that being that their staff resources at the local level is becoming more and more strained, that they might have to look at consultants to do the work. And I would just indicate that my experience has been that it's going to cost more for consultants to do the work than it is going to cost if it's done in-house at this point. But, I mean, we need to factor that into the dollars that we're talking about.
Yeah. Well, I trust you guys will be able to work together on at least agreeing on what that would be, so we would have something to work with. Yes, Mr. Clem.
Mr. Chair, Dan Clem, Director of Aviation. I just want to point out that one of the things that we looked at where we put a check mark, and by and large, most of the counties comply. So I want to make sure that we don't overblow this problem in terms of counties versus cities. But we asked them, why did you complete the work? And they indicated that they did it in conjunction with other comprehensive plans, amendments, and or land use actions, such that it was not a cost item for them. Be happy to look at working with the groups to continue that or to accelerate that as they do comprehensive land use plan. It sort of explains why all the check marks that are there, and most of the counties comply. Washington and Clackamas County particularly, and many of the rural counties have done an excellent job. I don't want to underscore that this is a problem where most folks haven't complied. With regard to the counties who were first affected by the airport planning rule, we see a high level of compliance where the cities weren't originally. I see more of our work there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Clinton. Any other questions? Well, we'll have you continue to work on that and kind of define the scope a little bit more, but I appreciate that very much. Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 169. We're still open on Senate Bill 170. Colleagues, Senate Bill 170, I have no one else officially signed up on 170. This is to extend the pilot program on through the fence operations. Is there others who would like to testify on Senate Bill 170? Senate Bill 170. Anybody else want to testify on that one? Okay. Then I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 170. And I'm going to ask that John Powell and Brendan McCarthy come forward on Senate Bill 171.
Mr. Chair, if I might, could I have Elise Brown come up as well? She's, her and I have a joint client.
Well, that's nice.
We have a
go ahead, Mr. Clem, go ahead.
And she smokes, I don't.
We'll let Ms. Brown come forward and make sure the client can see that both of you are working together.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing two clients in front of you today. Elise and I got an email last night at 11:02 about this bill.
Mm-hmm.
So that part of our work started late. Mr. Chairman, first I would talk on behalf of Oregon LNG, one of the three companies that has a proposal to do an LNG project in Oregon. That company has gone through the FAA process in Warrenton and the Astoria area, and Director Klim mentioned that the FAA has required them to purchase a new Doppler radar system for that airport. That is, my client would purchase that well over $1 million, and also affix certain kinds of lightings to their tanks and that sort of thing. Our amendment that I've worked on with Director Klim, and he was courteous enough to work with me on, grandfathers anybody who's currently in or through that process.
That's the dash one we have.
Right, that's the dash one. Now, he has since said that the bill's going to, he's going to propose other amendments, which would probably make that amendment change as well. But I just wanted to put that on the record.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, yeah. We have not distributed the dash one. Would you like me to do so?
How come? Go ahead, Doctor. Go ahead.
We thought it was dead until you...
Okay, thank you. I kept looking for mine. Thank you.
Go ahead and continue, though.
And secondly, I'll let Elise speak for our mutual client, AT&T. If you could just...
Sure. Just to say something quickly. Good afternoon, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. Elise Brown representing AT&T. And it was good to hear comments by the State Department, and would just further reiterate that AT&T and the wireless industry follows now the very strict guidelines by the FAA, and we would look forward to any further conversation and work towards a solution that would benefit everybody on this. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. McCarthy?
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, for the record, Brendan McCarthy representing Portland General Electric. Our project is one of the projects Director Klim spoke about, Bigelow Canyon 2, which came in second after the Klondike part on the south. The Bigelow is on the north part of that airport he spoke of. So we've talked about the problem, and we think there's a good way to get the ODA involved in the FSEC process early on, make sure that they are notified at the notice of intent stage so that they can participate in the process and make sure that FSEC, in the siting of these things, understands there's an airport, looks at flight patterns and safety concerns and that kind of thing. Happy to work with the committee, bring an amendment forward.
Well, we would really appreciate that, because I think the overall issue is an important one. Obviously, we have public purposes, airports with public purposes for power, but we don't want to put them in conflict with each other where we have to sacrifice one for the other because we didn't get together and figure out a responsible way in which both to go forward. Again, nobody's intention, but as Mr. Klim pointed out, it'd be kind of, you know, you start flying in, all of a sudden you have something in the way, kind of creates a problem. And it is incumbent on us to be at the table to plan this and make sure that the uses of all of those resources work, you know, harmoniously together and not actually injure one of them. So I appreciate your willingness to work on that, because I think the goal here is important. So to make sure that we have everyone speaking and understanding what's going forward so that it can be planned appropriately is in our best interest. Questions on Senate Bill 171 for any of our guests here or Mr. Klim?
I have a question.
Senator Starr.
And it might be for Klim, actually.
Mr. Klim, you want to come back forward?
Thanks.
Everybody else just disappears quickly.
I'm curious about the FAA process as it relates to towers or whatnot that might be near or adjacent to airports. Is the airport or the property owner, either one, required to get a permit? How does that process work with the FAA? I assume that there's some sort of fee involved. I assume that it's pretty comprehensive. But it sounds to me like there's a breakdown in the communication between the fact that you're not included or the Department of Aviation, Oregon Department of Aviation, is not included in that conversation. Is there a possibility where we could just link your department to that process and not have to create a new separate process for the property owners or the local airports?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, Dan Klim, Department of Aviation. Great question. There is a breakdown the applicant files an FAA Form 7460, sends it in. Studies, aeronautical studies, are completed by folks out of FAA's Atlanta office. They took a look at all the standard flight pattern issues, and they make a determination of hazard, no hazard. In the case of the Bigelow Canyon Phase 2 project, they made a determination of a hazard 3 weeks ago. I sent letters asking for the ability to petition to study the issue myself, because that is, we are the airport sponsor for the Wasco State Airport, the only public use airport in Sherman County, and I still haven't heard back from the FAA today. There is a breakdown in communication, but in fact, during the FSAC process, we as well had no ability to either know or comment on the application itself. Potentially could have mitigated the issue by altering, agreeing to alter the flight pattern, or work with the applicant to maybe move the pads 342 feet to the north. A couple of fixes like that would have been prevalent. Our Oregon statute only allows me to determine and direct marking lighting. That's it. I don't have your authority, although I would coordinate with the FAA, to issue my own determination about or mitigate issues at the site, the proposed construction, or at the airport. That there are instances where it makes better sense to allow the construction of the structure and make alterations to the flight pattern or the navigational aid serving the airport. That was the reason for bringing up the LNG terminal. So the process is broken, and I haven't found a way to be able to connect better with the FAA, but I'm concerned about connecting also with other federal agencies. I'd first like the explicit permission and statute to be able to do something there.
So, Mr. Chair,
yeah.
So I don't think we can pass an Oregon statute to tell the FAA to do anything.
No.
Is it possible that we in this process could make sure that if there's an applicant is working with the FAA in whatever process there is, that they would also have to copy you and any of the correspondence? I mean, I'm trying to avoid a duplicative process for both airports and the property owners, you know, and the cost involved with that duplicative process.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, Dan Klim, one of the approaches might be to allow us a permit, but in fact another approach that would give me the authority would be one of the ideas mentioned in one of the amendments, and that is to allow me to have more authority with mitigative measures beyond lighting and marking requirements for installation of navigational aids at airports. FAA would recognize the standing in the statute and allow me then to be a part of that final decision. Right now, if I know about it, I can comment on it, and that's it. After the decision's been made, I have to beg on a petition. Something's got to change that.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, so I think everybody knows their role here. We've got two different groups of folks working on two of these bills to see if we can come up with some language that meets an objective and the concerns that others have on that. And I would ask you to be with Mr. Stembridge, Mr. Klem, and with our cities and our counties and our utilities and others, and to see if we can come up with some solution, and then we'll get back together with you at that time.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much. All right, going to close the public hearing on Senate Bills 169 through 171. And we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 125. Mr. Stembridge, we heard this bill back on the 29th. And it's a work session, but for the purposes of questions, I'll ask Troy if you want to come forward in case there are any other questions. This is the driver's ed bill.
Yes, it requires ODOT to reimburse commercial driver training schools for traffic education courses provided.
Okay. And this was extending that to private providers as well as the public providers.
Anybody for motion?
Yeah, first of all, is there any questions for Mr. Stembridge? I mean, not Mr. Stembridge, Mr. Costales. Okay.
No. Go ahead. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 125 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Starrs moves Senate Bill 125 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? It's driver's ed.
Gotcha.
Is there any objection? All right, so ordered. How about, how about Senator Starr? Would you clear that for us? Senate 125.
Okay. Now we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 127, Mr. Stembridge.
Senate Bill 127 eliminates the mandatory one-year suspension driver's license. Actually, it clarifies responsibility for individuals to show proof of compliance with financial responsibility requirements after vehicles involved in uninsured motor vehicle collision. We have the Dash 1 amendment, but we may have failed to distribute it. We do have fiscal and revenue reports on that amendment.
I do have the Dash 1. Let's see if people have it first.
I don't have it yet.
Okay. Would you like to would you like us to get copies and distribute, or do you want me to show it around, or how do you want?
I do.
Check the back of the pack that was on the desk, because that's where mine was.
Maybe.
Senate Bill 127 is a. If not, that's nice.
1971. Check the packet that the staff distributed.
Yes.
I did. I don't have it.
And that's it. Let's get a few more made. Is that? And then before we begin that discussion.
Would anyone else would like a copy of this amendment?
Yes, I would.
Nope.
Sorry.
We're just going to be at ease for a few minutes, okay? Okay. Mr. Stembridge, would kind of walk us back for our original hearing and then the amendment that's before us?
This was on the 29th. This this has to do with Oregon's mandatory insurance law. Requires driver to insure their vehicles. If and it has to do with the procedures that take place if the driver is found to not have the required insurance. So it clarifies responsibilities for individuals to show proof, especially afterwards. It eliminates the requirement for statements for vehicle not operated on public highways to obtain an exemption. The amendment... The amendment simply specifies, clarifies... the offense of failure to make future responsibility filing.
Okay, do we have anybody to speak on the amendment from the department? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
What is the present law? I would think that this was redundant. What?
Well, we'll have our guest.
Okay.
The question for you.
Mr. Chairman of the Committee, my name is Lana Colley, DMV. The amendment is to fix the drafting that took out the owner of the vehicle from having to file an SR-22 if there wasn't insurance. The way it was worded before, both the driver and the owner, if the owner wasn't the person driving it, they both had to file an SR-22 if the vehicle was not insured. When it was drafted, it took the owner out. We didn't believe that's what the intent was, so this amendment puts the owner back in as well as the driver if the vehicle's in an uninsured accident and they did not have coverage. They have to file the SR-22. So this, our amendment essentially puts it back to the way it was as far as the owner and the driver both having to report, but it also clarifies the reporting requirements. Because there were some changes that didn't get fixed when the reporting requirements for an accident was changed back in 2003.
If you could, for the benefit of the committee, I think getting to what Senator Verger did, could you walk us, just take us back to our meeting of last week again on the overall need for the bill, and then so we can put in context the amendment again, just to, as a refresher for the committee.
Sure, I'll try to do that very concisely. What we were trying to do is remove some old language that we don't need and we don't use, make some changes to make it equitable so both the owner and the driver have to file the SR-22. There was one part of the bill that the driver got a mandatory suspension, but the owner just had to file the SR-22. We removed that language. There was some language that allowed an owner of a vehicle to submit a statement to us that the vehicle wasn't being continuously operated on the roads. Well, if it's not being continuously operated, it's not required to have insurance anyway. So we removed that language. There was some language in there that we had to notify the county DA. We've never done that. They don't want it. And then we also put some time frames in there for the insurance companies to notify us when we're asking for information about whether the vehicle was covered by insurance or not. So it was really just a kind of a cleanup to get all that stuff fixed. The amendment was to fix the drafting problem, and then there's also another amendment to add the risk retention group, which was something that DCBS Insurance Division had asked us to do, to include them along with the surplus lines insurers.
Another amendment in addition to this amendment?
Yeah, it was part of the dash one.
Oh, okay, that's what I thought. That's what you said that it kind of...
Yeah, sorry. No, it's part of this dash one amendment.
Okay.
To add those as well.
Okay. And so they won't have the automatic suspension now like we had in the previous bill, in the previous law?
Correct.
Right.
They'll have to file the SR-22, get their insurance, and then if they don't do that, then they get the suspension.
So it just doesn't happen right away.
Yeah.
Ready for motion?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 127.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 127. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? It's ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 127 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 127 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? It's ordered. Who would like to carry this bill?
I haven't carried a bill, Mr. Chair.
Then, like Senator Berger, I think you're the car lady.
Perfect.
So
lucky day.
That's perfect. Okay, let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 147. We will not be moving this bill today, but we're going to just kind of update you with it. So, Mr. Stembridge.
Senate Bill 147 requires landscape contractors license for persons maintaining ornamental irrigation systems using compressed air.
So, remember this one. Now, we don't have any amendments yet on this, correct? I know we have some coming, but...
There's no amendment on
it. No amendments yet, okay. And I do have a request for some additional amendments. You want to come forward and address the committee on what you would like to do?
Thank you very much, Chairman Metzger. My name is Kevin Curry, and I'm representing the Oregon Association of Plumbing, Heating, Cooling Contractors. We're a trade association that represents contractors across Oregon. Working with the UA Plumbers and Steamfitters Local 290, as well as the Plumbing Mechanical Contractors Association, we wanted to propose an amendment to this bill that would exempt a person who holds a valid journeyman plumber certificate or is an approved journeyman plumber apprenticeship from the licensing requirements of a landscaping contractor for the purposes of installation of piping of irrigation systems. Presently in law, licensed journeyman plumbers are able to maintain or repair irrigation systems, but they're not allowed to construct them. So this would give them the opportunity to actually put the pipes in the ground.
Okay.
There's some real-life examples of water feature that's in the inside of a commercial building, for example. A plumber's not allowed to plumb up to that water feature under this law. They can plumb the whole commercial building, but they wouldn't be able to do the water feature portion of it, as an example.
Okay. Any questions? Why don't you stay there just for a moment, and let's get everybody up here. Patrick Griffiths, City of Bend, do you want to come up?
Chair Metzger, Patrick Griffiths, City of Bend. I'm the Water Utilities Coordinator, and I'm here really at the request of Senator George had a request to hear our utility perspective on using compressed air and if it was a real issue or not.
Great.
I'm happy to answer questions if you have those. We have 24,000 service connections at the City of Bend. Every season, about fall season, we have a lot of these compressed air tow-behind compressors show up in Bend from all over the West, and they tow these around and blow out their irrigation systems. We get probably two or three calls every season from compressed air showing up at people's taps, which means that they've been incorrectly done, and we get compressed air coming out of people's taps. And it's not the compressed air that's the risk. It's the pulse of contaminated water, potentially contaminated water, that goes in with that. We've had water and air show up three or four houses down from a point of connection, which means that that air and the water slug has moved through our distribution system back out of the house connection, down the street, and up into other houses. So we know this happens. We don't catch all of them. We don't hear all of them. If we went back and looked in October and November records and we looked for taste and odor complaints and pressure complaints, we would probably find more of these instances. We rely on trained professionals to really protect our system on a variety of different ways. Cross connection is one of our biggest risks. 24,000 potential contaminants every point of connection to our distribution system. So we take that pretty seriously. Anytime that we can use an existing statutory authority to help protect our investment is a good thing, in our opinion. And we think this would be a really good addition to our web of protection to our customers, both public health-wise and safety.
Okay. Senator George has some questions.
Yeah. I guess here's my question to you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that I'm trying to figure out, from a realistic perspective, the public health or safety issue on this. Have you ever had any testing at all done on whether or not this is a health hazard at all?
Chair Metzger, Senator George, great question. This has been the heart of the question on the whole cross-connection issue, the potential of the risk of health. And so for us, the documentation exists, probably the best place exists in the committee booklets for the cross-connection control program. They have a whole manual of incidents based on cross-connection. Not all of them are derived from compressed air issues. This is just one that could happen. So we have to look at all these potential, weak spots in our protective system. This is one of them. We feel this is a low-cost protection that really builds on existing educational training and licensure requirements that are already in place. We don't want to have to be redundant and create local conditions. This builds on something that's already in place, and I think is a really smart way to go about it.
Hold on, Mr. Chair. I guess what I'm trying to get at is that I'm having the water is injected. The water is put into the system through your system.
That's right.
So I'm trying to understand what the cross pollutant would be, other than compressed air, which is taken out of the air.
Right.
And the only way I could possibly see there could be some cross contamination is somebody actually put some kind of pollutant in the irrigation water. And I'm not sure exactly how that works, but I'm trying to find out if there's any. I mean, you said if you went back and looked, there could possibly be complaints about odor that could be connected to this. I'm really looking for some kind of nexus because this is a pretty big reach for me to.
Chair Metzger, Senator George, great question. Again, let me drill a little bit more. Out of our 24,000 service connections, we have about 2,000 to 3,000 customers that have what we call a dual plumb system, which means they have a non-potable water supply attached, plumbing-wise, to our potable system. They typically use that non-potable water for irrigation during the irrigation season. When they turn those systems off in the fall, they blow those systems out. It's a typical way to get the water out of the system. And so that's the risk period when they can push contaminated water or non-treated water back into our distribution system. That could come out of the taps. It could cause sickness and health issues to the residents of those individual homes. We also have other customers that use fertigation and other irrigation techniques of putting fertilizers back through these non-potable systems. That's another risk that we're concerned about. It's not as prevalent in Bend because we're a little less agricultural now, but again, it's another potential that happens in sort of the outlying areas that use this technique of blowing air back into these systems that possibly could even get into private wells, not necessarily our utility.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Mr. Gers, thank you for coming over from Bend to address the committee and help us understand that a little bit better.
Appreciate it.
Would you like to come forward? You've heard, I'd like to have your comment, first of all, on the proposed amendment regarding the licensed plumbers, and then any other questions the committee may have, and then we'll continue to work on this piece of legislation.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, I'm Mike Snyder. I'm the administrator for the Landscape Contractors Board. Thank you for letting me come up here. This is the first time I've heard of the amendment. Nobody's talked to me about that. I did like to clarify one statement that he made is piping inside of a building is not our jurisdiction. Plumbers do that solely. If there's a water feature inside of a building, we do not have jurisdiction over it. So that's a plumber's thing.
We've had some members who have had run into that problem, so there's a disconnect somewhere.
And then for the issue around them doing irrigation systems, landscape construction professionals are tested for exactly landscape irrigation systems. They have the testing and the qualifications to do that. Plumbers do not have that deal for specific for irrigation systems. That is something that's carved out of statute for landscape work, for landscape plantings. So we'd be willing to look at that amendment with them. This is the first time I've heard of it. Thanks.
Okay. Do you have any comment on that?
We met with the other two coalition members on Tuesday, which is why this came up at such a late date. I apologize for that. We think that the journeyman plumbers have the skill level to do this type of irrigation installation, and certainly would like to get an amendment drafted and then continue discussions certainly with the landscape.
Well, that's exactly what I'd like to have you do. I'd like to have the two of you work together, see if you could come up with a consensus that does or does not make that inclusion, and for whatever reason, contact Mr. Stembridge at that point, and then at that point I'm going to ask you to circle back with the members of the committee, and then at that point we'll make a determination of when the bill will come back. How's that?
Okay.
Anybody else have any questions at the moment? Okay, then let's close the work session on Senate Bill 147. So, Mr. Stembridge, Monday,
you have four landscape or construction contractors board bills, plus you have a reconsideration on Senate Bill 136.
Okay.
Possible reconsideration, I should say.
Okay. Anything else come before the committee? If not, we're adjourned.